That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to That Money Show live on FUBAR Radio with me, Gabriel, That Money Guy, here to do one thing and one thing only, and that is to make you better with your money. Every single week, I say the same thing. Schools don't teach it, universities don't teach it, your job is definitely not going to teach it. So this is pretty much the only place in the entire world, I might be exaggerating, so don't fact check me here, but the only place in the entire world where you can spend an hour every single week enjoying yourself, sitting back, just stick your headphones in, and I will 100% make you better with your money by the end of the show. And how do I do that, I hear you ask? Well, every single week, I firstly love to tell you what's going on within the economy, specifically the stuff that's going to affect the money inside your pocket, not the boring stuff, no boring news. I'll catch you up on the actual relevant stuff. And on top of that, we bring in some really interesting guests, famous faces, and personal finance experts to share their own stories, personal finance advice, and experiences, because I think that is one of the best ways to learn about the topic. And we'll also answer some of your questions and just have a general good old chit chat about the topic of money. Some people don't like talking about it. They think it's taboo. Not me at all. So who do we have coming up this week on the show? We've got Ryan Kingsley coming on a little bit later. You might know him as @ConsultKingsley. He is a qualified financial advisor and a mortgage broker, and he's going to talk to us about all things ISAs. If you haven't heard that acronym before, please stick around. If you have heard it before, also stick around. And also we have Bola Sol, a financial advisor and author of Your Money Life, to talk about financial literacy and where you might be going wrong with your finances. So quite the show up ahead of us. I would say this is going to be a very interesting one, and we're going to dive straight into the news because that's what we like to kick things up with. And the headline number one is Lloyds sets aside $1.2 billion for car loan scandal. That is $1.2 billion with a B. This isn't PPI. This is the latest car loan scandal that some of you might have heard of, some of you might not have heard of, but I will bring you up to speed. So I think it was actually around 2021 when the FCA brought out this ruling. But essentially, car salesmen were being a little bit sneaky when it came to car loans, car financing schemes. And yeah, I'm talking about car salesmen who you might traditionally have already thought of as slightly sneaky people. But what was going on here? And it was actually a little bit of a, I want to say like a plot, but I don't want you to kind of like imagine some kind of evil supervillain sat in like some lair that's come up with this. But it was just a bit of a lack of honesty. So what was happening was car salesmen try to sell you a car, especially on car financing schemes. They can make cars pricing seems very attractive. And this is one of the biggest, I suppose, catches within the personal finance world, how everyone thinks that all of a sudden it's affordable to drive a BMW or a Tesla or a Mercedes. You might see your friend on the same salary as you driving one of those cars, and you're like, how on earth are they doing it? That's because car salesmen are very good at manipulating the numbers. What they can do is they can ask you what your budget is on a car, and they'll just, you know, spread out the payments a little bit further. Perhaps you were thinking about you buying a £20,000 car over a 4-year period, and the payments were a little bit too steep for you to afford that level of car. They'll just say, it's fine, we're just going to stretch out over 5 months. Four years. They'll stretch out over 5 years. That's one of the tactics that car salesmen can do. A lot of people might be fully aware that they're doing this and be going into it fully open-eyed, but a lot of people are not. And another element of the whole car finance scheme is that you're not just spreading out the £20,000. You're spreading out £20,000 plus interest. Of course, they're lending you the money. Therefore, they would like you to pay them back the money plus interest. And the levels of interest on some of these car finance schemes are incredibly high. I'm talking about ridiculously high levels of debt, high interest debts, some of the worst kinds of debt that you can get yourself into. One of the kinds of debt that I often am saying on this show to avoid, and if you are in, try and aggressively get out of it as hard as you can. And car finance schemes are one of the biggest culprits. I'm talking about, you know, 8, 10, 15%, sometimes even higher than that when it comes to you wanting to finance a car. You might have heard different terms, leasing, PCP, HP. These are all different versions of car financing. So what was the scandal and why exactly have Lloyds set aside £1.2 billion for this scandal? So going back to what I was talking about, the FCA found out and looked into it. And it turns out that banks were incentivizing car salesmen to increase the interest that they were charging you on your loan scheme. So if they could charge you 10% and get it up to 12%, the person selling you that car with an even higher interest would be compensated by the bank, because, of course, everyone wins. If they can lend you the money and get you to pay it back plus a higher level of interest, it's in complete favor of the person lending you the money. And the person actually lending or financing these schemes were banks. They were just kind of going through the car companies. So they get more money and therefore they give commission to the salesman for getting them some more money. Sounds kind of nice. But what wasn't happening was the person buying the car was not being made aware of the fact that these higher interest rates that the car salesmen were trying to push them towards or trying to get them on, they just weren't being transparent about this topic. So millions of people, millions of motorists were essentially given higher interest rates without being made aware that there was an incentive as to why they would be given these higher interest rates. And often these higher interest rates might have just occurred. They might have just been sneaky and the car salesman would have played around with the numbers a bit. Or alternatively, when they stretch out the length of your loan, that might come with a higher interest payment. So let's say if you can pay it back in 3 years, we'll give you 10% interest on this deal. But if you pay it out over 4 years, it goes up to 12%. And they'll say, oh, do it over 4 years. You know, your payment actually goes down from £200 to £150 a month. Not so good. Not so good. The FCA have stamped down on it. And since 2021, this has been banned. But they then started to look into compensation for people who had bought cars in this way and had kind of been susceptible to this scandal, to the idea of not being transparently told what was going on behind the money. And Lloyds were one of the biggest financiers of car finance deals. They had already earmarked £450 million. This is now going up to £700 million extra to a total of £1.2 billion with a B to cover potential compensation schemes. To give you some comparison for whether that's a lot or not, Barclays have set aside £90 million. Santander have set £295 billion. That would be an interesting amount of money. And Lloyds Bank are at £1.2 billion. And this is for around 2 million new and second-hand cars who are sold using these finance agreements every single year. So if you are someone who was, you know, is on a finance scheme, definitely pre-2021, I would look into whether you are due some compensation for this, because, you know, you were missold something or you were missold things without full transparent information. And like I said, we bring you the news that will actually affect the money in your pocket, and you might end up with more money in your pocket thanks to hearing about this article. Next, backbilling. Has anyone heard of the concept backbilling? Because I actually hadn't really heard of the official title of this. I heard of the concept, but never the word backbilling. And what it is when a company charges you more money for something that happened, for energy that they were supplied over a year ago. So let's say 15 months ago, you missed an energy bill, you never got billed on it, or you get a letter through the post from, I don't know, British Gas giving you a thing saying, you know, 15 months ago when we charged you £200, we actually meant to charge you £220. That is back billing, going back by longer than 12 months, giving you a new bill for energy from longer than 12 months ago. Now, this was banned by Ofgem 7 years ago, but is still going on today. And Ofgem are demanding that these energy firms get rid of all of this backbilling or could face some fines. I mean, this is pretty terrible by these companies. Sometimes I feel like these companies are kind of a little bit too big to even realize the shit that they're doing, because backbilling to them is just another letter, probably some through some automation system. They didn't even realize that something was going out, and you, the person, is just getting a bill that they don't really need the money. They know that it's illegal to charge for it, but like, it's some automation they don't know how to sort or fix. And then you, the customer, get a bill from 15 months, 17 months ago, and it just puts in another a huge amount of stress on you, thinking, oh my God, how am I going to find this extra amount of money that I just wasn't even aware of? I thought I'd already paid this bill. Like, and it just adds stress. Sometimes these back billings can be, you know, significant amounts of money. And so, like I said, to the company, it's nothing. It's just an automated thing that's gone out. But to you, the individual, it's quite horrifying. So absolutely, this needs to be rectified. And Citizens Advice said they received 47,000 complaints about billing in general in 2023. And that's gone up to nearly 60,000 in 2024. So it's becoming a real, real issue. And back billing is happening to thousands of tens of thousands of people. So again, affecting the money in your back pocket. If you're getting a bill from over 12 months ago, a new bill from over 12 months ago, it's illegal. And there are, I think, pre-written templates that you can email back to your energy supplier to make sure that you do not have to pay that bill. So please go type in online back billing template, and Ofgem have it on their website where you can go in, literally copy and paste the email, add your own specific circumstances. This is a very common thing when templates are given out on the internet for you to try and sort yourself out with financial stuff, is that people just copy and send exactly what it says. You need to actually change it to A, include your name, your address, your information, your right company, and the information that you are actually specifically referring to. Do not just copy and paste it. The company will receive that letter and have no idea who you are or why you just copied and pasted a letter off the internet. Very important to say. A few years ago, I kind of started to discover this idea called EU261, which is where you get compensation for flights. We'll save it for another show because it's a really interesting concept where you are legally owed compensation for delayed flights. And there's a template online for people to use, but it started to become reported that people were just copying the template online that literally was saying, like, dear blah, 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 sincerely, John. And people were literally just sending in the letter from whoever this John person was about a random flight that was part of the template and not actually changing it to their specific circumstances. Guys, like, spend 5 minutes. We're talking about real money on the table here. Spend 5 minutes just changing it. And lastly, I don't know if you guys have heard of the WASPI women. These are the Women Against State Pension Inequality. Well, they're back again. Well, they've never really went away, but they're back again. If they were in the news quite a lot over the past year, and they're back again this year. Because they are threatening the government with legal action over refusal to pay compensation. So to just give you guys some context about who the WASPI women are, millions of women who were born in the 1950s, known as the WASPI women, they weren't given sufficient warning that the state pension age for women was being lifted from 60 to 65. So imagine your state pension age just jumps up from 60 to 65. Those are 5 years where, you know, women who are just born in time get to retire at 60, and then the women who are born just after a deadline have to wait another 5 years to receive their pension, to be able to retire and get all of that money. So that's a significant amount of money in their pocket. Well, they've been suing, I think, the government for quite a few years, and they're going again, threatening the government with legal action because Keir Starmer has said that they do not have the $10 billion to pay these women. And yeah, it's a bit of an interesting one because Rachel Reeves has been quoted in the past saying that she believes it was an injustice that the WASPI women were not paid out. Now, she is the Chancellor of the Exchequer. She is control of the government's purse strings. And apparently they don't have these £10 billion to pay these WASPI women. Just saying that the Pensions Act that was brought in affected these WASPI women, which is all about kind of bringing the women's state pension age parallel and in line with the men's state pension age, did save the government around £30 billion. So maybe they want to just dip into a third of that and pay these women. But of course, not up to me. Up to the high courts, up to the government, and just another thing to be aware of. So if you do have a parent who was born in the 1950s, a mum, a grandma, you know, someone in your family that's part of the WASPI women, make sure they're aware and they are part of the collective in case compensation is paid out in the future. You don't want them to be missing out on that. Anyway, stick around because after this, I'm going to be joined by Ryan Kingsley at Consult Kingsley. Oh, that's very hard to read, by the way. Consult Kingsley, a qualified financial advisor and mortgage broker, to talk all things ISAs.
Fubar Radio.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
And we've got Miss Chloe Brockett in the studio.
It got to the point where I wasn't enjoying it as much as I used to. I used to love it. You know, it was my life. I wasn't in relationships because I was going on TOWIE. I wasn't, you know, invested in anything other than the show because I loved it so much. And then as I got older, I just didn't enjoy it anymore. I noticed that the cast around me had changed. All the OGs had gone and I'd all of a sudden become an OG at 23. And was a bit like, you know what, I don't think this is for me anymore.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
One in five people in the UK are disabled, and it's not always visible. So if we've made ourselves at home in priority spaces on the bus or train, surrounded by our shopping bags or bikes, we could be making it harder for the people who need that space more than us. So let's not forget about the people we share our journeys with, and keep priority spaces clear for others. Remember, it's everyone's journey.
When it comes to heart attacks, you might be surprised to hear the symptoms don't always feel severe. You could experience a squeezing across the chest, a feeling of unease, a sense something's not quite right. Don't be tempted to dismiss the signs and wait to see what happens. The faster you seek medical help, the better your chances. It's never too early to call 999 and describe your symptoms. Your NHS is here for you.
Politics Uncensored.
They can't turn off your water because water is a human right. It's not like internet, which we can talk about.
Are you saying
we
should all stop paying?
I'm not saying we should all stop paying. I think no one should have to pay.
Their argument would be prices are going up. We need all this money because we have to invest in our ageing Victoria infrastructure, which hasn't, there's been no new infrastructure built in sewage, whatever, since the Victorian era. How would you respond to that?
They're talking out of their backside. It's bullshit of the highest order.
What the hell with Gabby Allen?
Mr. Later Williams, hello! Mate, can we just address that you did Strictly Come Dancing?
I know, people were quite upset about that, to be fair, but listen, not the first musical theatre performer to be on Strictly, won't be the last. I've never watched a full season from the start to the end. So when it actually got 2 hours, I was like, whoa, like, there's so many different styles. I was like, oh, and Nikita, I love him, but he was really pushing me to be the best that I could be.
Making personal finance simpler with Gabriel Nussbaum. This is That Money Show.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to That Money Show live on FUBAR Radio with me, Gabriel, That Money Guy. And it's time to talk about ISAs. Not on my own, because joining me is Ryan Kingsley, or you can find him at Consult Kingsley. He's a qualified financial advisor and mortgage broker, and he is going to have a little conversation with me about the world of ISAs. It's a really interesting topic if you haven't heard about it. And if you have heard about it, there's still going to be some good stuff in there as well. So, Ryan, welcome to That Money Show. How are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm doing good. Not too bad for a Monday in London. It's just been rain and sunshine.
So basically a typical February day here in London. I'm looking outside my window and I've got sunshine now, but I'll let you know if it changes to rain. And talking about sunshine turning to rain, I feel like that's pretty much summarizes what Rachel Reeves is currently having a little discussion about when it comes to the world of ISAs. Currently, I would say we're in a bit of a sunshine position. Not a perfect sunshine. It's not warm as well. It's just the sun is shining. That is all. We get our ISAs, £20,000 across all different types of ISAs, and we'll dive into exactly what they mean in a minute. But the cash ISA is one that's going to be affected. The Chancellor suggesting that we should limit it from £20,000 down to £4,000. How are you feeling about this news?
So, mixed reaction, really. So, for investors, it's not going to make a difference because they'll still have the full £20,000. But for people that like to be very, very cautious with their money, want guaranteed returns and easy access, it's going to massively affect them. Coincidentally, you know, Labour have been accused of kind of attacking pensioners, but the vast majority of ISA holders are those who are over 60. They hold the largest share. So I don't think it will affect the majority of the population. There's only about 22 million have ISAs in the UK, only a third.
Wow. Yeah. Why do you think she's doing this in the first place? What's the intention behind, because you get £20,000 across all your various types of ISAs, and maybe it's even worth us reversing back to the beginning. But first, what is the reason why she's looking to lower the limit specifically for the cash ISA?
To encourage growth. Now, there's obviously rumours that it's kind of big banks want to get platform fees, and that's kind of pushing it. But fundamentally, the tax benefits are usually related to risk and return. and or risk and reward more accurately. And with the cash ISA, there's no risk taken. So should people benefit from that, where other people take risk and pay tax?
Okay, cool. Shall we? We'll take a little pause and we'll go back to a bit of an ISA 101, because I think that there's going to be a few listeners who are going to be like, okay, you're talking about ISAs. I've already turned off because I've got no idea what that even is. So what exactly is an ISA? What are the benefits and what are the main types here in the UK?
So ISA stands for Individual Savings Account. They've been around since 1999, so 25 years. And essentially, they enable people to save in the most tax-efficient way. There's no capital gains tax to pay on any growth of your money. There's no dividend or income tax. And each tax year, April to April, you can put £20,000 into the various types of ISAs. There are five types of ISAs, primarily cash ISA for those who like safe returns, easy access, stocks and shares for those who are taking a little bit of risk, lifetime ISAs for those who are looking to kind of save towards a property, and I can explain the benefits in a bit, innovative finance ISA for those that kind of like those peer-to-peer lending. And then you've got the old help to buy ISA, but there's several types.
Brilliant. And there's also a junior ISA, which can be transformed into two different types. So what is the junior ISA product?
So the junior ISA is fantastic for parents who are looking to save for their children. So if you're under 18, you can open your parents or guardian can open a junior ISA on your behalf and save up to £9,000 every single tax year on your behalf. And that's invested as you see fit, whether it's in a cash ISA or a stocks and shares. But more importantly, there's no income tax, no capital gains tax. It's tax-free. It's fantastic.
So these are some of the most tax-efficient ways of saving your money. And like you just mentioned, they're basically parallel versions of every kind of account that already exists out there. So the cash ISA is just a savings account where you don't pay tax on the interest that you earn, you do if you go over certain limits and thresholds in a normal savings account. The same with the stocks and shares ISA. It's just a general investing account, but again, with the benefit of not having to pay tax when you sell and make profit, hopefully make profit on your returns. Obviously, nothing's guaranteed in the world of investing. Lifetime ISAs, innovative finance ISAs, and junior ISAs are obviously slightly more niche and specific products. But I think that's a great overview. And for those people that are currently looking to save money or invest money, your first port of call should quite often be looking towards an ISA and using your ISA allowance per tax year. Like Ryan mentioned, £20,000 April to April, and it refreshes every single tax year. Okay, so like we mentioned, there's tax benefits, there's lots of various types. Why would someone choose to not go into an ISA versus to go into an ISA?
So pension is by far the superior product. Like the pension is actually a Ferrari when it comes to investing. We can do that for another time, but it's generally a mistake if you don't open an ISA account, unless you just want it in your bank account sitting there with no protection, no growth, then great. A lot of people open a general investment account by mistake because they're new to investing. Probably one of the biggest mistakes that happens, especially on platforms like Trading 212. But everyone should open a stocks and shares ISA to be saving. It's by far the best way.
Love it. Nice. Easy to explain. The answer is you probably should go for an ISA 9 times out of 10. What are some of the most common mistakes that people make when opening an ISA? So are there kind of pitfalls that people need to be aware of? Because some people might think it sounds like quite a niche product and I need to know something about it before I open one.
So fees, charges, and performance are really important. Outcome is more important than the fees, the charges, the performance. What is the purpose for you investing or saving in the first place? Is it to save for a house? Great, you need a lifetime ISA. Is it to save, but you need access to the money? So just to put your emergency fund, where you can easily access it, but in the meantime, it's getting some interest, some growth. And then, stocks and shares is high risk. So which platform do I choose? It's a big mistake that people make. They're not sure which one to choose. Sometimes they just go with their bank. And then choosing really risky investments is probably... Yeah, most people don't need to take the whole of market risk, where markets could go up, 20%, 25% like last year, or go down 37% like they did in 2008.
Yeah. Those are some of the key risks. Yeah. I like it. I'll give you another one that I've heard is people that, well, this is with the stocks and shares ISA in particular, people that put money into a stocks and shares ISA but forget to actually invest it. And now this might sound really silly. You might be thinking, huh, what do you mean? But a stocks and shares ISA is a little bit like a supermarket, right? You go into the supermarket and you've got your money inside there, but you haven't actually bought any products. You're just inside the place that has the products. You need to actually go in and, you know, buy your fruit, buy your veg, buy your pasta, whatever it is. Those are the either individual companies or, you know, funds that you can buy, ETFs, so many different variations and options. That's where the slight complexity goes. But that's a mistake that I've heard, where people just literally go in, they dump their money in an account, and these accounts often don't pay any interest. You are literally just then got your money flat, and they're like, oh, why am I not getting any returns on my investments? You haven't actually invested it, mate. That's a really key one. Okay, so we've added some context to the conversation now, and I feel like we should go back to the whole Rachel Reeves situation, because you can put £20,000 in across all your ISAs. Currently, that means if you wanted to, you could put £20,000 just into cash ISA, just into stocks and shares ISA, just into lifetime ISA. Well, not £20,000 into lifetime, only £4,000 into lifetime. There's some niche rules, guys. We don't have an hour. We can't cover every single thing. But now there's this idea, or Rachel Reeves is currently looking into the concept where she's going to limit your cash ISA down to £4,000. Currently, like I said, you could put 20 if you wanted to into a cash ISA and have that as your entire ISA allowance for the year, but coming back to four. Now, my question is, you said the goal is growth, and most commonly, her goal is growth, if not British growth. I think the whole idea is to grow the British economy. She's not looking to grow Donald Trump's economy. That one is strong enough as it is at the moment. But if I was a betting man, and most people were limited, and then they, for example, were being pushed towards the stocks and shares ISA product, that gives zero indication that they're going to start all of a sudden buying British companies. So how can that be guaranteed, and why is that the motive, where most people will go, you know what, I'm just going to go for an all-world ETF or an S&P 500?
Absolutely. So this is where it's a bit of a contradiction, because who does it really benefit that is the big question mark here. So yes, you know, you can open a cash ISA with your bank and invest in that, but there's no guarantee that people will buy into UK companies. I think the UK industry in terms of investing, the market is like massively undervalued in terms of what it can achieve going forwards. We kind of sort a few political things out. it's a mixed bag. I don't think it's going to affect the vast majority of people. Out of the 22.3 million people that have an ISA in its various forms, only 1.6 million last year, according to an AJ Bell study, actually used the full 20,000. So halving it, I don't think it's, or doing this, quartering it, isn't going to make much of a difference to the average person. But in terms of boosting the British economy, I just don't see the path for it. I don't see the reasoning.
Yeah, it seems a little bit illogical, and it just kind of seems like all she's going to do is alienate a large part of the base of people that probably voted to put Labour into power by taking away what is arguably one of, I suppose, the personal finance economy's favorite tool in the market. This is some people's favorite tool. Listen, there are problems with it. There are issues, for example, you know, the lifetime ISA and its limitations that it has in terms of the property price, or for example, the fact that it hasn't gone up, the amount that you can invest into an ISA in total, like £20,000, hasn't gone up with inflation. I feel like you might have another few problems with it yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of people obviously come to financial advisors such as myself to kind of choose the platform, choose the investments, do the retirement planning for them. A kind of a hidden benefit of a stocks and shares ISA, or an ISA of any kind, is that, especially for those that are married or in civil partnerships, is when you pass away, I know it's a bit morbid, but when you pass away, your full ISA allowance and the value in it is inherited by your partner. So they can benefit. So if you had, you know, £100,000, you know, your partner had £100,000 in a stocks and shares ISA or whatever it is, they can inherit that and receive that full allowance going forwards on just the amount that's invested.
Mm. So really many hidden benefits.
It's incredible. And so limiting to people that are very cautious, specifically elderly, and making them save a lot less means that there's more potentially taxable going forwards in the future.
So with news like this about the ISA product coming under threat by our own Chancellor, what would you be telling people? Is it time to start withdrawing your money from the ISAs? Is it time to fill your ISAs up as much as possible whilst you still can? Or is it just normal practice as usual until anything is announced?
Absolutely. Normal practice as usual. Same with the rules that were announced in for inheritance tax back in the autumn budget. Nothing still happened. The consultation period ended couple of weeks ago. So, yeah, business as usual.
Business as usual until something actually changes. Don't start panicking. I do remember this back in October before the budget came out. People were moving money and got seriously burnt because they were just trying to get ahead of the curve.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you're not within a flexible ISA, for example, and you start withdrawing your allowance this year already, you start to lose that allowance and that can't be regained. A flexible ISA, by the way, just being the ISA product where if you withdrew 5,000, you still can then put back in that 5,000 at some point within the same tax year without it affecting your ISA allowance. And we've only got a minute or two left. And I think the only other questions I'd love to ask you is the lifetime ISA. We left with a little bit of a question mark hanging over it. So would you be happy to do a little 60-second deep dive on one of the more complicated ISA products?
Sure. A lifetime ISA you can open between the ages of 18 and 39 up to and contribute up until you're 50. You can invest £4,000 every tax year, get a 25% or a £1,000 government bonus. So 25% extra for free every year just for contributing £4,000, let alone the investment growth, which is all tax-free. And if you decide not to buy a house up until 60, there's a 25% exit penalty. But a lot of people are also using it for retirement planning to get additional bonuses and then accessing when they're 60. But it's a great product for buying a first-time or for a first-time buyer.
Yeah, the caveat being the amount that property has to cost.
Very low.
So it is very low, and it's getting lower every year as house prices go up every single year. We're about to probably see house prices on average cross over £300,000 in the UK for the first time. I think we're at 299 as of last month. And the price your property has to be is below £425,000. Now, I'm not saying that's not a lot of money to buy on a first-time property, but if you live in the South or the Southeast, the lifetime ISA product is one you want to really think about, because the penalty means that you're not only paying back the bonus that you get, but a little bit more as well. So a real big caveat. Anyway, Ryan, thank you so much for your time. Where can people find you if they want to learn a little bit more about this topic of money that we love to discuss?
Thank you for having me at Consult Kingsley on TikTok.
At Consult Kingsley on TikTok. Ryan, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Well, there you have it. That was ISA 101 for you. I hope if you haven't already, you start to look into that product right now. I mean, we've pretty much given you the DL on it, so you're welcome. But it is an incredible product that if you want to invest, if you want to save, if you want to save towards a first-time property, there are real incentives here behind it. Do not pay unnecessary tax. It's a really important thing to be aware of. You pay enough tax. You pay your income tax. You pay your national insurance tax. You pay your council tax. You pay tax out of your ears in this country. Don't pay more on the interest that you're earning just because you're not aware of the ISA products. Now, I want to give you a money tip of the week, and that was not it. The money tip of the week wasn't don't pay tax. Pay tax. Just don't pay more tax than you need to. But my money tip of the week is actually something to do with a product that predated the junior ISA, and this was a child trust fund. So listen up, if you were born between the 1st of September 2002 or the 2nd of January 2011, okay? Or if you know someone that was born between those two dates, that's absolutely fine, because if you were, there is a high chance that a child trust fund was opened in your name as a long-term tax-free saving account. And if you are over the age of 18, or if you are a parent of someone who is over the age of 16, if you are a parent of someone who is under the age of 16, but born between those two brackets, I would go online and type in find a child trust fund and find how much you have in there. Most of them were opened with between £50 and £750. And in the period since 2011, or since whatever year you guys it was invested for you for the first time, that money could have grown significantly. I have friends that have found upwards of £2,000 sat in an account that they otherwise would have left there completely untouched forever. So go ahead, find your child trust fund, and then be sensible with it, guys. Like, actually be sensible with it. This isn't like free money for you to go and buy that MacBook Pro that you've always wanted to buy, or to buy an iPhone, or to go out and buy fashion clothes. I mean, it is. It's up to you, really. But this is a great place for you to start a really strong savings habit at a young age. And that would really be what I love to kind of instill in people. I can't make you do whatever you want. You will be 16 and getting a lot of money if you do end up finding one. But yeah, I would just say, like, think of that money show when you do it. Just think of that money show and my face judging you. No, I'm not judging you. Just trying to find you guys some extra money. I'm just trying to be helpful. Anyway, guys, stick around because after this, I've got Bola Sol coming on the show. She is a financial advisor, the author of Your Money Life, and she's going to talk to us all about financial literacy.
FUPAR Radio.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Miss Chloe Brockett in the studio.
It got to the point where I wasn't enjoying it as much as I used to. I used to love it. You know, it was my life. I wasn't in relationships because I was going on TOWIE. I wasn't, you know, invested in anything other than the show because I loved it so much. And then as I got older, I just didn't enjoy it anymore. I noticed that the cast around me had changed. All the OGs had gone and I'd all of a sudden become an OG at 23 and was a bit like, you know what, I don't think this is for me anymore.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
Yeah. The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
It was calm on the beach, so I took my little girl out on the water. Then we hit the wind, and it blew us out to sea, faster than we could paddle back. And we learned our lesson from these guys, the crew who got us home. Thank you.
Respect the water and watch out for the winds. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Registering to vote means you can take part in the way decisions are made in the UK. When you register to vote, you are then able to cast your vote at local and national elections. You can help choose who runs your area and makes decisions about things you care about. Millions of people in the UK aren't registered to vote and they miss out on having their voice heard. It's quick and easy to register. It only takes 5 minutes. You can do it online or you can ask for a paper form at your local council. Register to vote now at gov.uk/register to vote.
Politics Uncensored.
They can't turn off your water because water is a human right. It's not like internet, which we can talk about.
Are you saying we should all stop paying?
I'm not saying we should all stop paying. I think no one should have to pay.
Their argument would be prices are going up. We need all this money because we have to invest in our ageing Victoria infrastructure, which hasn't, there's been no new infrastructure built in sewage, whatever, since the Victorian era. How would you respond to that?
They're talking out of their backside. It's bullshit of the highest order.
What the hell with Gabby Allen?
Mr. Later Williams, hello! Mate, can we just address that? You did Strictly Come Dancing.
I know, people were quite upset about that, to be fair, but listen, not the first musical theatre performer to be on Strictly, won't be the last. I've never watched a full season from the start to the end. So when it actually got to it, I was like, whoa, like, there's so many different styles. I was like, oh, and Nikita, I love him, but he was really pushing me to be the best that I could be.
That Money Show on FUBAR Radio with Gabriel Nussbaum.
Hello, welcome back to That Money Show. I'm Gabriel, the host, That Money Guy, and joining me now on the show is Bola Sol. She's a financial advisor, she is an author of Your Money Life, and she's going to be talking to us all about financial literacy and where you might be going wrong with your finances right now. So, Bola, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
That's absolute pleasure. Now, let's start off with the very basic, the very beginnings of it. What on earth is financial literacy? What is this term that gets thrown around the whole time? And why is it so important to be aware of even those two words?
Yeah, so financial literacy is essentially about the level of understanding you have when it comes to everything to do with your personal finances. Doesn't mean you need to understand all the terms of, I don't know, finance in a more detailed manner, such as people who are investment bankers, but it's more about how well do you understand what it means to look after your money and just personal finance in general. Like if somebody says to you something like APR, do you understand one, what it stands for, and two, what it means?
Absolutely. There we go. To a T, explained so well. And why are you so passionate about bringing financial literacy into the mainstreams? Like, what's the issue here? Why can't people just keep going on with the status quo?
Oh, I just don't think the status quo is still up to quo, if you will. I find that it's still quite terrible. And because it's something that's not taught in school, I'm not too, what's the word, cross at anyone who doesn't understand it. So I feel like there's a real gap there. I remember, and I speak about this at the start of Your Money Life, when my friend and I were first talking about, you know, how we're going to make it in life, it was, I remember talking to her about certain terms and she didn't understand it. And it made me wonder, if she doesn't understand it, how many other people don't understand it either?
Yeah. If I'm speaking from firsthand experience, I had zero formal education in the world of finance. I think that most people probably resonate with that sentence. It isn't part of mainstream education. There are some schools that are brilliant and are putting it into the curriculum and are doing an amazing job bringing in external resources. But it is just still a massive uphill battle to get it into education. I mean, your financial habits are set, a recent study said, at 7 years old. And I mean, if you can think that they're set at that young of an age and you're wondering why you're bad at money in your 30s, you might be because you're between 7 and 30, you have literally been taught nothing on the topic, which is scary to think about. I mean, schools and education systems, they love to teach us how to make money, right? That's the whole point. They teach you how to get a job, how to find your career, how to pursue your passions, probably not the last one so much, but how to get a career, how to get a job, but never what to actually do with the money on the other side of it. So what are like the key misconceptions? What are the key barriers that people put up to you when you're trying to bring financial literacy to them for the first time?
Oh, some of the key barriers is, first of all, they've always been bad at math. That's one that comes up a lot. But with the tools we have these days, do you have to be good at math to be good at your finances? There's spreadsheets with formulas in them. There's calculators. So I'd say that's one of the first ones. I'd also say a lot of people say they don't know where to start, and that's literally where I come in, because I also do coaching. So I kind of give people a to-do list of things to do, you know, list out your income and expenses, usually in the form of a spreadsheet. But I find that those are maybe the top two, or just a generic, I'm bad with money. That's that's always a real generic start. And I think, yeah, I think sometimes people use that as a way to essentially say that whatever I'm about to show you, I've told you in advance I'm bad with money. So if I now say to you, I've got, I don't know, debt over 3 cards, I'm not budgeting properly and so on, they feel like by saying that sentence, I should be less shocked. But I come with no judgment.
That is really key. And yeah, this idea, you know, I'm bad with maths, I was never taught it in the first place, it's overly complicated, it's a really difficult subject to get my head around, there's too much complicated words. I think it's just part of what society has poured into the world of finance. You think of someone who's good with money and they wear a suit and they have a lush job, they work in the city, you know, they understand these terms because they're superly high educated, they've got a degree in financial whatever it is, and that's what you need to be good with money. But that couldn't be more false. Like you mentioned, you don't need to be good with numbers to be good with money. There are so many things that are out there to assist you. And I would love to kind of, I know we don't have an hour or a week or a year where we could give everyone every single element of what they need. But I mean, if we were to just start with some of the basic things, inspire people to walk away from this conversation with 1, 2, or 3 things to get started, where can people kick off their financial literacy journey?
Oh, you say where, so it's not tips. Is it more of a where,
what, when, why? I'll give a few tips, a few things, places, that things they can think about to start getting better with their money.
I would say, first of all, everyone needs a budget. A good budget is where you can start. A good spreadsheet, in my opinion, is what everybody needs. It doesn't have to be super high tech. It can be, you can buy one, you can buy some online, or you can get a free one. But the key is that you keep going back to that budget and you use it as a toolkit to see where your money currently is and why. And then I would say the next key tip, also just to go back to that budgeting point as well, there are apps that you can budget on. Essentially, it can check amazing apps, and then you can literally check your budget in real time and see, for example, have you spent too much in a particular category? Where do you need to come down, and so on and so on. So I think that's the key, real time, because a budget on a spreadsheet is not in real time. You can say, "Oh, I'm going to spend £100 on food," but the real time budget through an app, for example, can say, "Hey, you spent £140," so it's a real quick, you know, kick up the peach to like let you know that, okay, maybe I need to change my budget. Number two, I would just say everyone needs an emergency fund. I don't care how much money people make. People laughed at me on Twitter before because I said people making over 15,000 a month should have a budget. And then luckily accountants came to defend me because the whole point is that it's not about how much money you make, it's about how much money you keep. And if something is to go wrong ever in life, and let's be honest, we can't plan everything, mm-hmm. you want to make sure that you still have a buffer, if you will. So that's so important. And that buffer is not the same as having long-term savings, for example. Some people mesh it together, and it's not something I think is a good idea. But if you have lots of money, it's easy to separate it. But if you don't, then it's a different thing. And then what would I say my third one is, for example.
Oh.
Yeah. My third.
Yeah, I was going to jump in for you, but I'll let you take the third one because I feel like you've got it there.
Thank you. I would say my third one is, after you have done the saving, just start investing. Even if you start small, even if you start with a demo account because you don't want to start with your own money, because you're not sure your attitude to risk, I think what's key is that you know that your money can grow past whatever interest rate you're getting, as well as deducting current inflation rates. So yeah, that's definitely the thing I'd say.
I like it. We're talking budget. It's a boring word, but it's money is meant to be boring. It's meant to not be exciting. So lean into that. You had investing, even if you're starting small, which I absolutely loved, and build that emergency fund. It's not the most mathematically optimal thing to do with your money, but having a buffer psychologically, I can't even explain to you the feeling of having an emergency fund, that knowing if something goes wrong, like, you won't be put under any financial stress whatsoever. It's a game changer with your money. It is literally a game changer. And like, people laugh when I say the word emergency fund. They're like, oh, it's fine. I'll just go back and move with my parents. It's fine. I was like, do you want to do that?
Yeah. And do you know what? Late last year, I had to literally clear out my emergency fund and I literally felt financially naked. Everything felt like, oh my gosh, there is no buffer. There is no buffer. I didn't want to do anything because I needed to get that buffer back. I was like, I don't want to go out. I don't want to do this because there is nothing covering me if something happens.
Yeah. The other thing I always say about emergency fund is please actually spend your emergency fund in case of an emergency. I remember I got someone was asking me, being like, hi, like my car's broken down and I've got this really high expense. Like, should I be using my emergency fund on that? And I'm like, yes. Like, I mean, I can't tell you exactly what, but like, is it an emergency to get your car fixed? And did you see this as an expected cost? Probably not. So I think like people sometimes build the fund and then are too worried to spend it in the first place. So I think that's really, really important. I want to kind of circle back to the topic of financial literacy in current, you know, in the economy that we live in society that we live in right now, and just understand from your perspective, what needs to change? If there is someone listening to this show that can start to make those changes, I mean, me and you are two advocates. We're trying our hardest to do what we can and make these changes. But what role do government, do education, both formal, informal, need to start, you know, playing in order to develop financial literacy? Why are we falling so short?
Yeah, I think it needs to become something that there needs to be a minimum quota, if you will. So for example, in schools, I think it's important that we are taught personal finance. So obviously we are past that schooling age, but I think it should be like extra mandatory class, for example. And then I actually think in, let's say, 9-to-5 jobs, where possible, there should be, you know, lunch and learns, and it must be compulsory that maybe at least twice a year there are people who come in and educate others on finances. I think it's key. And if you're self-employed, maybe there's something the government can do and maybe pull us all in. Pull us all in with some sort of Teams or Zoom, for example. But I think it should be mandatory that we're all learning, because it only comes at our detriment when we don't know.
I agree. And it comes at companies' detriment, lower productivity, the amount of stress that financial burdens put on people. If you have a financially savvy, literate and safe workforce, you probably have a more productive workforce as well, which probably means higher profits for your company. In the meantime, before this happens and before it becomes part of the status quo, which hopefully it does by tomorrow, but it probably won't, what can people do to start raising their own financial literacy?
Oh, I think that there's a good handful of people that they could like follow online. Of course, you are one of them, and so am I. But I would also say that there's books. For example, your Money Life. I talk about money in a very kind of straightforward way for people to understand it. There is a wealth of information, but I would always say books are a great place to start. Don't feel like you have to read everything from start to finish in one go. But if you just pick up a little bit by bit, just know you'll get better and never stop learning when it comes to financial literacy. See, I started my year by reading a finance book, and whilst I knew most of it, it's just because I really just enjoy refreshing. It's a bit like physical health. You don't stop going to the gym because you've hit your final form. So
Which
keep going,
book?
keep learning.
Any recommendations aside from Your Money Life?
So I like The Psychology of Money.
Oh,
I
great
like
book.
Laura Whateley's Money. I think A User's Guide, it's fantastic. Manila Sukho, Get Your Money Right. Anna Brading has a fantastic book. I'm trying to remember it off the top of my head.
Money Mentor.
The Algebra of Wealth. Yeah, that's it. Money Mentor. Thank you. The Algebra of Wealth by Scott Galloway as well. I think he's
So many
incredible.
options.
And so many.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really hope that these conversations inspire people to take financial literacy into their own hands. Whilst it's not being mandatory imposed onto them, it is something they should mandatorily impose onto themselves, because it will drastically change your life for the better. I can say that because I've done that for myself. You can say that you've done that for yourself. So, you know, what more examples do you guys need? Where can people find you online? And if they want to check out your book, where can they find out a lot more about the money education you're putting into the world?
Oh, thank you. So if you want to get a book, you can go onto the penguin.co.uk website and just type in Your Money Life, and you can choose a retailer of your choice and get it from there. And of course, you can find me on Instagram. What's all the other platforms? TikTok. X Threads. You have some videos on YouTube as well. Bola_soul is where you can find me on Instagram. I think it's just Bola Soul on TikTok. And yeah, if you
There we
just type
go.
it in, you'll find me usually ranting about money.
Perfect. Go look up Bola. She is wicked in the topic of money. Thank you for your time, Bola.
Thank you.
Well, there we go. Bola is an absolute powerhouse in the world of financial literacy, so I could not recommend more. You go and check out her stuff, check out her book. Great places to start to inspire yourselves on your financial literacy journeys. Now it is time for your audience questions. You guys DM us on @ThatMoneyShow on Instagram, and I am the lucky guy that gets to answer these questions. And Ray, you are up first. Ray, you have said, I am in £2,500 worth of overdraft and credit card debt, and I'm worried my credit score will be ruined forever. Are my worries legitimate? Your worries are legitimate in terms of the fact you should always be concerned when you're in debt. That is an absolutely fine worry, and I assume your worry means that you're taking action to get yourself out of that. But in terms of your worry about your credit score being ruined forever, the answer is quite simply no. Bad credit can last for up to 6 years from the date of default, mispayment, court judgment, whatever it is. This is true even if you don't end up paying off the debt. So 6 years is how long bad credit normally lasts on your file. I wouldn't say get yourself into bad credit or bad debt and wait 6 years for you to be fine, because most cases there are other consequences and complications around not paying off your debt. But it won't ruin your credit score forever. So a lot of young people, when they're 18, 19 in university, go into overdraft. You normally should probably try to find an account that allows you to do that. But if it doesn't, it'll have negative effects on your credit. But sometimes you just have to think to yourself, do I need to have good credit right now? In the next 6 years, do I have any objectives with my credit? If the answer is yes, it might be worth trying to build your credit score through other means, and that there are loads of ways to improve your credit. Just Google online how to improve my credit score. But if not, don't stress. You can always amend it and fix it in the future. Sonny, what have you got for me? You have said, how do I start building an emergency savings fund if I'm supposed to be saving for a pension, an ISA, etc.? Question mark. Okay. Basically, how do you build an emergency fund when you're meant to be doing other things with your money? You're meant to be investing. You're meant to be putting money into a pension. You're meant to be saving for your holidays. You're meant to be, you know, putting a little bit aside for today's spending. Look, I think it's a very key question, which is like, there are loads of things you're meant to be doing with your money. How am I meant to do it for an emergency fund? So an emergency fund should be one of your first priorities. That and high interest debt, getting rid of those two are commonly seen as the two most, the fastest things that you should be doing to build your personal finance moat kingdom. So to do it, often people say 3 to 6 months worth of living costs to get to a full emergency fund. But it's a very big goal. It's very intimidating to think to yourself, let's say you're earning £2,000 a month. That's at least £6,000 put away as an emergency fund. So what a great way to do is just do it in stages. Get to £500. Start just there, a £500 emergency fund. Then get to £1,000. Then get to £1,500. Then get to £2,500. And then get to £5,000. And then you can decide from there whether you want to keep going up if you are risk averse, or if you want to stay down because you, you know, are quite risky. So it's all up to you, the exact amount within your emergency fund, but just start a little bit every single month. And perhaps, like Bolo was saying, she stopped spending to rebuild her emergency fund. So you might have to be really frugal in an intense period to save your emergency fund, because they're really, really important elements for you to have sorted. So yeah, that is exactly how I would do it. Anyway, guys, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. So if you do have any more questions, please DM on Instagram at That Money Show, and I will try and put it to the top of the list for next week. I want to say thank you to Bolla and for Ryan for their time today on the show. Hopefully you learned a lot about ISAs and financial literacy. You can download FUBAR Radio app and listen to us live. You can listen to us back on every good podcasting platform. I have been That Money Guy. This has been That Money Show. And as promised about an hour ago, you are now better with your money.
FUBAR Radio.